Is Britain suffering from premature invitation?
This is London Calling.
I'm Graham Mack. Welcome to the programme. Donald Trump is big news in Britain right now. Last week, the Prime Minister, Theresa May, met with the President at the White House. The two of them talked about the special relationship that Britain and the USA have, and Theresa invited Donald on an official state visit to the UK later this year. The day after the Prime Minister left Washington, the President signed an executive order that the media are calling the Muslim ban. That has led to protests all over Britain, and an e-petition to stop the state visit was signed by over a million people. In Britain, if a petition gets 100,000 signatures, it's debated in Parliament. That happened yesterday, but after the debate, members of Parliament decided that Donald Trump's state visit will go ahead as planned. The strange and very British thing about the petition that sparked the debate is the wording of the statement that more than a million people have put their names to. It doesn't mention prejudice or discrimination. It doesn't say that the executive order is morally wrong and doesn't represent British values. It says this: Donald Trump should be allowed to enter the UK in his capacity as head of the US government. But he should not be invited to make an official state visit because it would cause embarrassment to Her Majesty the Queen. That's right. Our biggest worry is that he might embarrass the Queen. Which shows that although we've come a long way as a country and as a democracy, we're still basically all just peasants. We don't have freeways in Britain because we're not free. If you drive on Britain's roads, you're more likely to get a speeding ticket now than ever before, even though we've never driven so slowly. I've been going on about these smart motorways. They're playing the old shell game. They have the shells with the P under it. They're moving around. Where's the P? And they do that with the speed limit. What it is our motorways are not wide enough. So what they've done is they've created this smart motorway, which is a series of gantries, I'm guessing roughly every quarter mile. And the gantries now open and close the hard shoulder. And they also have a variable speed limit on them. So whereas in this country, when we were free, you used to just be able to drive at 90 on the motorway unless you saw a cop. And then you could slow down, go past the cop, and then carry on again at 90. Now what they do is they put us on a smart motorway, the maximum you can go is 70. Because if you go under one of those gantries, there's a speed camera on the backside of the gantry that will snap you. If you're doing more than 70, you'll get a ticket. But it gets better. Because it doesn't stay at 70. It goes up and down like a you-know-what's draws. So now you can be doing 60 miles an hour on a motorway and get a ticket. Because you didn't notice that the last gantry, it had dropped to 50. Whereas the one before, it was at 70. And they just keep changing the speed limit on each of these gantries. So it's taking you longer to get from point A to point B, yet you're more likely to get a fine. But remember, it's not to generate revenue. Okay, so smart motorways. They now catch, the old shell game now catches 1,000 drivers a week on smart motorways. Things that were, that they say were designed to ease congestion, not to make money. 1,000 motorists a week are being caught on the UK's smart motorways. This is just on the smart motorways. Last year, 52,516 fixed penalties were issued on 11 smart sections. That's included on the M1, the M25, and the M6. So let me just make this clear. Cops didn't catch people speeding. The smart motorways just sent the ticket in the post. It's the most efficient way of collecting money that the government has ever come up with. And They manipulate your guilt because you think, oh, yeah, well, I was speeding. I shouldn't have been speeding. You might have only been doing 40 on a motorway, but if that sign had gone to 30 and you missed it because it was at 50 at the last one, they've got you. You never know where you're at on a smart motorway. There are more than 236 miles of smart motorway in England, and a further 200 miles of smart motorway is currently either being planned or under construction. Now, to give you an idea of how much this has increased, 52,516 tickets were issued. Guess how many tickets were issued in 2010 to 2011? It was 2023. It has gone from 2023 speeding tickets to 52,516 tickets. Now, they say that the whole idea of giving speeding ticket is to reduce the amount of people speeding. How's that working out for you? If the amount of people speeding has gone from 2023 to 52,516, you're not reducing speeding. The fines aren't working. Because you don't want the fines to work. If the fines work, you won't make as much money. This meant that the revenue going to central government every year increased from 150,000, well, let's call it £151,000 5 years ago. The government used to make £151,000. Now they make £1.1 million. One stretch of motorway in Scotland on the M9 saw the annual number of tickets increased from 9 to 41. Almost 250 people were caught speeding in the first 3 days after enforcement was introduced on the M4 near Newport. See, they built this smart motorway, but they didn't switch it on for 5 years. I wonder why they waited. They thought, no, we can't. We switched it on, and in 4 days, they got 250 people. Find them. So there's no way that those... We're not talking about here. We're not talking about crazy, dangerous drivers. We're just talking about normal, hard-working people who are being gouged by our government in this shell game. And the government are laughing their heads off. This is not increasing road safety. It's not reducing the amount of people breaking the law. It's turning ordinary people into criminals. And it's making a poo load of cash along the way. I'm on the M6 just north of Birmingham on Saturday, about a third of a mile in front of Junction 10A. I'm in the outside lane. It's a smart motorway. And it's got it up at 60 miles an hour. So I'm doing exactly 60 miles an hour. And I've also had the speedo tested. And actually, where mine shows 60, I'm doing 59. It's pouring with rain. I come up to the next gantry and I see it. I see it changed from 60 to 50. And I know there's a camera on the other side. And I see the painted lines on the road. Although I don't want a ticket. So I put my foot on the brake to slow down from 60 to 50, and then all hell broke loose. Because I caught a glimpse in my mirror of the guy in the Vauxhall behind me bounce off the crash barrier, and then he spun round, and as he spun round into the next lane, he clipped me on the back left-hand corner of the car. Thing is, if he hadn't have hit that barrier and had taken the impact out of it, he would have gone right into me. I would have done a lot of damage. Now, I get over to the hard shoulder and I look down the road and there he is. So I put the hazards on, put my coat on, walk back down the motorway. And all that time, my car's parked in the hard shoulder. All right, I've put the hazards on, but it's in the hard shoulder on a pouring wet day on a motorway where sometimes you can drive in the hard shoulder, sometimes you can't. All you need to have is somebody confused and someone's going to wipe out my car. But that's dangerous in itself. Sometimes hard shoulder, sometimes not hard shoulder. Who knows? So I walk back to this fella and he's pretty shaken up. And his car, well, the right-hand side of it's just wrecked. I mean, he's driven into the side of the motorway barrier, concrete barrier, hasn't he? His headlights all smashed up and it's undrivable. So I'm pretty sure modern cars, that's a write-off. He's probably bent the frame or something. I mean, serious damage. So, you know, we exchanged insurance details and all the rest of it. And later, this is before 9 o'clock in the morning. I tried to call my insurance company, nobody there. So later on, when I was near Telford, I called them up and I gave them all the details. They didn't want to know. They said, you got to call his. I thought, when you're fully comp, your insurance company goes and sorts it out with theirs. So I won't be renewing with them again. I can't tell you who they are, but their initials are E. Shaw. Yeah, lucky to be alive, but all because of the smart motorway. You know, because the guy went into the back of me, it was his fault. But there was no need for any of this. If we had normal motorways like we used to have, I wouldn't have had to hit the brakes to get a ticket, because it's a £100 ticket. They're just a cash cow, and now they're risking people's lives. Let's check in with Mrs. Davies. Mrs. Davies, what do you think about Donald Trump? Should he be given an official state visit to Britain?
No.
Why not?
Because he's a dirty old... Well, obviously, eventually he will come, but it shouldn't be a full state visit yet.
I mean, we gave the Chinese leader, we gave him a ride in the royal coach with the Queen and tea with the Queen.
The Queen wasn't very happy about it. But
how do you know that? You don't know the Queen. And she's not said anything.
I
she's not allowed.
Read,
you
don't. I do read the newspaper.
And the Queen is not allowed to say whether she likes it or not. You've made that up, Mrs. Davies. Okay. Now, should we have a state visit? Should Donald Trump be given tea, roll out the red carpet, tea with the Queen, the rest of it?
Eventually.
Well, what's got to change? She hosted Putin.
I think it's her decision. It's not anybody else's.
Well, it turns out she's not made the decision. It turns out that Theresa May has made the decision for her.
Okay.
So you think he shouldn't come now? We should wait. Wait for what?
Well, better weather for a start.
Better weather. Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mrs. Davies.
Okay.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Let's get to part two of my interview with Kate Bulkley. She's an American media journalist based in Britain. In part one, you heard her story of how she grew up in Colorado and then made the move to London. I asked her about the main differences that she'd found between the media in the USA and in the UK.
Well, it's interesting. We're in the middle of... looks like the Murdoch family is going to try to buy the rest of the Sky.
Yes. I'd like to get your thoughts on that. So please.
Yeah. So it's obviously a moving story right now. So it's an interesting story. It's not like they haven't tried before, because they have. And of course, the first time they tried, there was this huge scandal with the hacking scandal and Millie Dowler. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was all tied in with their newspaper coverage and the end of the News of the World. Actually.
For anyone who doesn't know, there was a certain newspaper, the News of the World. Some say there were more papers than that at it. And they were hacking into mostly celebrities, but all sorts of people's phones and checking the messages on the phones. And it was a big, big scandal here probably about 3 years ago. But still, you know, the aftermath of that, it was a huge thing. And it really did scupper Rupert Murdoch and 20th Century Fox's chance to buy Sky.
They ended up withdrawing their bid because there was such protest over the whole thing. So, it was all this fit and proper person rule. And there's a lot of regulations in the UK, which is getting to the answer of your question, that we don't have in the US, which in some ways I think is a good thing, by the way. Mm. Anyway, I would say that probably the biggest difference that I've noticed is... you have a regulator here called Ofcom, and they're kind of like the FCC, but they have different kinds of powers. And one of the things that is inside of the rules in the UK is that a television channel has to be, or a television network has to be unbiased. In other words, a broadcast network has to be unbiased, whereas a print newspaper can have a point of view. So we all know, for example, the Telegraph is a little bit more right-wing than the Guardian, mm-hmm. right? These are two newspapers. But in the States, it's exactly the flip side. The papers tend to be sort of don't have that much political positioning, but the television channels are particularly political. In other words, you know that if you turn into CNN, it's going to be more left. You know that MSNBC is even more left. You know that Fox News is going to be way right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you know, and that's a huge difference. And I think it's actually quite an important difference, particularly as we're looking at what's been happening in the world and this whole rise of fake news with the internet and the whole idea that what I would call more traditional or legacy media, like television, like print, is having to figure out how to be noticed in this new world where we have the internet always on, where people are getting their news from all kinds of sources that aren't necessarily, you know, and I put this entre guillemets, or, you know, in quotation marks, you know, legitimate. They tend to have a very particular point of view. So, you know, if you want to stand out, you almost have to become more screechy or more, you know, persuasive or louder or something like that. And in the States, that has manifested itself in the sense that, you know, you can get talk shows on any of the networks that are basically people screaming at each other, which is just weird, you know, as far as I'm concerned. But it's definitely changed the whole tenor of, I would say, political debate and dialogue, because it's not about listening to someone and responding. It's almost just who can scream the loudest or who can be the most, you know, outrageous. And we've seen it writ large in this current, you know, election with Mr. Trump and Hillary Clinton. And the fact that, you know, I would challenge you to think of one policy issue that Trump actually really explained during the campaign. It was mostly just about taking shots at Hillary. And so anything that Hillary was trying to say, it was hard to know what her policy position was because she was always batting these things back. So it's just changed the nature of what I would say political dialogue. And I think it's a real threat to democracy, to be honest. I mean, I think it's a very, very serious moment in the world and certainly in journalism.
Did the US media fail during the election campaign? Because I didn't see him being challenged that often. In fact, I didn't see Hillary being challenged that often.
The media all around the world, but particularly in the US, because of some of these rules and because they're trying to stand out, were really having a hard time trying to figure out how they were supposed to be. You know, how far do we push them? What are we doing? Who are we trying to? I mean, I seriously think that we're having a crisis of, I don't know, what we're about, what we're actually trying to do. And the thing that's so sad about it is that journalism should be, I mean, it should be a very integral part of any democratic country. It should be the place where you can get your voice heard. It should be the place where you're hearing alternative views. It should be the place where you're getting a journalist who's actually looking at both sides and then giving you some kind of reasoned, you know, idea about what it is that is happening. That's the whole role of journalism. I think we've sort of lost focus on that because, again, the economics are imploding under our feet. I mean, you know, I mean, any newspaper that's still standing, and many of them aren't, is really having a crisis of how to make money. They've had to cut their staffs. Investigative journalism is down to, you know, almost nothing. So the print press is having a hard time. The broadcast press, again, similar problems. There's so much other noise out there. They've got to somehow stand out. Certainly in the States, they're becoming more, let's say, biased one way or the other. I mean, those shows that were coming on during the U.S. election campaign, where you'd have like this whole panel, there'd be like 10 people on the screen, sort of all shouting at each other. I'm sort of like, you know, what is this? Is this really helping, you know, average Mr. Voter or Mrs. Voter figure out?
Yeah, it's just become sport, isn't it?
Yeah, it's almost like sport.
And so in Britain, is it better in that regard then with British broadcasting?
Well, I used to think it was, and I think it still is. I think this last election with the whole Brexit thing underlined some of the issues, though, that we have in this country. Again, it's that similar kind of move towards what I call personality politics and sound bites.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the fact that people don't get challenged, or if they do get challenged, nobody hears it because there's so much other noise going on out there. So, you know, so Nigel Farage can stand up and say that £350 million is going, out of the NHS to, you know, see what I mean? And nobody, even if it gets challenged, nobody hears it because, oh, well, it must be right. He said it, you know. So there's kind of this, it's almost like people have their fingers stuck in their ears and they're going, nah. You know, it's like they're not actually listening. And when they do listen, it gets so sort of vociferous and segmented that you can't actually hear anything. In fact, well, here's an interesting thing. I mean, Mark Thompson, who used to be the director general of the BBC here, is now the head of the CEO of the New York Times. And he's actually written a book, and he talks about sort of how the rhetoric of public debate has just become so strained and mixed up that it's very hard to actually have a reasoned conversation. And he says this is a huge problem, you know, going forward for democracy.
Yeah.
That's why we're seeing the rise of the demagogues. I mean, that's what everybody's seeing. You know, people want somebody who's going to say, I will fix it for you. The problem is over there. Don't worry. Stick with me. I'll fix it. I'm a deal guy. I'll make it better.
Was the obsession with balance something that hurt, in particular, the BBC with their coverage of Brexit? Because a lot of the claims that were being made by the Brexit side, the Leave Europe side, weren't being challenged and fact-checked maybe as much as they should have done. And that was it because of this obsession with the balance?
Well, the thing is that the BBC was doing what it's always done, which is trying to be balanced. And I think that in large part, they were balanced. I mean, I know lots of people say, oh, the BBC is left-wing biased and things like that. I think it's actually quite a balanced news organization. You know, it's a huge enterprise. But, you know, I think they do a pretty damn good job. The problem is, I don't think people want to hear balance anymore. I think that people are, particularly people who voted for Trump and the people who voted for Brexit, there was almost like a protest vote. It was sort of anti-establishment, anti-elite, anti-professionals, anti-people that know anything. You know, it's almost like we've had a kind of a backlash. And I have a theory about this, which may or may not be true, or maybe there's some truth in it, because I don't think anybody has the real answer to this. But one of my theories is that part of the problem is that particularly Western democracies, you know, that have always been the growth engines. We've always been growing at a certain pace. And, you know, obviously the people at the top tend to have more benefit from that. But there was always enough growth that the people in the middle and the bottom felt something. Yeah. You know, at least the people in the middle felt something. And the people at the bottom we took care of because we had enough money to have a social safety net. Now what's happening is the growth is slowing in America, in the UK, in Western Europe in general. The big growth engines now are not in the established Western countries. It's, you know, India is a growth engine. China is a growth engine. That's where, you know, Brazil, these are where the economies are still growing. We're not growing as fast. And so what's happening is that you're not, the ships aren't rising. You see what I mean? All the ships aren't rising. And so the people in the middle are feeling particularly squeezed because they're sort of thinking, well, wait a second. You know, my dad used to say that, you know, he wanted a better life for me and that was possible. You know, his dad said it to him and suddenly I'm getting to where I am and I can't promise that to my kids. It doesn't look like this is happening. You know, I don't see that. And that's scary, very scary. And people are scared and they're looking for what I would call solutions. And they don't see the solution in the way things have been going. And they're willing in some ways to give up maybe things like political correctness and, worrying about their fellow man because they're scared for themselves. And that's why I think we're seeing this sort of movement to protest votes and what I see is a movement more to the right because they're basically sort of saying, let's take care of me. It's all about me. It's not about the civilization or the society or my community. It's about me.
Where do you think things will go if it turns out that Trump can't keep his promises and Brexit does not save Britain? And will people wake up or will they stay in that delusional bubble that the media has been feeding them?
I don't know. I mean, and I don't know if the media has been feeding them a delusional bubble. I think that
from what they've got from the media, that is when they've gone two and two. That's what they've said, two and two equals. So, yeah, I wasn't accusing the media of deliberately doing it, but of, you know, stories about immigration and things like that. They just feed into this, this delusion that it's all the problems in my world will go away when this happens, whether it's Trump president, Brexit, whatever it is. What do you think? Will people wake up when they realize that the world's a bit more complicated than that? Or will they continue to just make it fit the narrative that they want?
Well, I think it comes down to something that President Obama actually said. I think he did it in a I can't remember if it was on a video. I think I read it, and then I think I also saw it on a video. And what he was saying is we really have to rethink what he called the social compact. And I think he's right. I mean, we have to understand that people are not going to buy into sort of the liberal perspective of the world if they don't feel like they're getting any benefit, and if they feel excluded, or if they feel like they're not participating. So we have to sort of rethink what that's all about. You know, what is it we're actually trying to do as a community, as a nation, as a, you know, as a state, as a region? I mean, it's almost like you have to get back to basics and figure out what it is we're actually trying to do. Why are we living together in a community called the United Kingdom or America? You see what I mean? And that's why you're starting to see this centrifugal force that's kind of throwing everything out of the pram. You know, why do you think Scotland was trying to get out of, you know, the UK? It was sort of like, we're better on our own. We can, you know, do our own destiny. Why does Britain want to get out of the EU? Oh, we're better on our own. We'll be in charge of our own destiny. We have to go through this, unfortunately, I think, in order to kind of see what it is. What it is we're all about again. I think we've lost track of what it is we're all about again. And how that's going to look on the other end, I don't know. I don't know if anybody knows. I just hope it's going to be better. I hope we don't all, you know, kill each other, that somebody pushes the nuclear button at the wrong time. I mean, I think it's the scary bit about right now is that because there's such uncertainty about what we're actually supposed to be doing and how to fix this, quote unquote, that there's just a lot of almost knee-jerk reactions. I mean, and Trump is the perfect example of this. He just says stuff. You know, it's kind of, and you're thinking, have you thought about how this is going to impact, like, our relationship with the Chinese? I mean, that you're talking to Taiwan and on a diplomatic level, and we haven't done that for like four decades. Have you like thought this through, Donald? Obviously not. So, you know, I mean, it's a bit scary. Because, you know, we're sort of into new territory. Now, is that going to yield some results? Well, I hope so. But I don't know. I mean, it for somebody who, you know, I'm educated and I have a master's degree in international relations. I studied diplomacy. I studied, you know, balance of power. You know, when I was going through school, we still had the wall was still up, for heaven's sake. So it was all about, you know, how you do the Cold War and how you balance things out. So the sort of throwing everything up in the air and sort of saying, hey, man, let's see if this works is a bit scary for somebody who, you know, grew up the way I did and was educated the way I was, which I think is why, for example, the Washington political establishment is going, what the heck is going on here? But, you know, hopefully there'll be some good coming out of it. I think the same in Britain. I mean, you know, it's a very difficult moment for this government. You know, how do they do this? You know, they got the government, part of the government is pro-Brexit, part of the government didn't vote for Brexit. They've got to figure out how to make Brexit work. The EU is not particularly happy to give them any, you know, coddling at all. I mean, why should they? Basically, they've walked out of the European experiment saying, sorry, we don't like it. None of that stuff. But we also, by the way, we also want to continue to trade with you. I mean, that's really hard. You know, it's really hard to sort of say, we'd like part of it, but not all of it.
With no bargaining chip. We've already walked. Okay, well, I'd like to finish off, because it is that that time of year, with some predictions for 2017 with media. We don't know. I'm not going to hold you to these. Just complete speculation.
Oh, crystal ball. That's so much fun, Graham. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, it's that time of year, you know. Rupert Murdoch's 20th Century Fox, is he going to get full control of Sky?
I think he will. I think that there will hopefully be some conditions put on it. For example, one thing that he agreed to the last time around, and I think he probably should agree to this time around, I'm personifying 21st Century Fox, but 21st Century Fox should agree to, would be to roll out Sky News into a separate company so it isn't part of the same company that owns Fox News. So that we have, because, you know, Sky News is basically a very balanced operation in terms of their
it's
news.
It's not like Fox at all. No.
It's not like Fox. So we don't want it to become like Fox for a lot of reasons, but the primary reason is that's not the way television news is supposed to be in the UK, right? As we discussed before. So I think that he probably will get it through. But I think that I hope that there will be some conditions put on what he's able to do. I think on one of the reasons he will get it through, I mean, there'll be a lots of back and forth about plurality of voice, and there are some real issues there, because even though the company that is trying to buy Sky is not actually the same company that owns the newspapers anymore, because he split those companies, right?
Yeah,
so there are two separate companies controlled by the Murdochs, that one runs the newspapers and one runs the entertainment business, which is the Fox and 21st Century Fox and Sky, well, 37% of Sky now and possibly the rest of it. So, but there still will be some plurality issues, because they'll say, well, they're separate, but are they really, you know, will there be some, so there will be issues like that. But I think that on the other side, just to talk about why this is happening, the media business, and here's a big prediction for 2017, the media business, particularly the legacy media business or the traditional media business, like 21st Century Fox, like Sky, like NBC Universal, like Comcast, like all these companies, are buying up each other as fast as they can, because they're trying to create scale, meaning size, and they're also trying to create what we call the entire value chain. So from production of content through distribution of content. Why do they want to do that? Because what they're seeing is that the big digital global platforms like Google, like Facebook, and to a certain extent like Netflix and Amazon, are able to do things in a very different way and are basically gathering into themselves all of the new advertising revenue. In other words, digital advertising is going up like this. It's very much an upward curve. And advertising on television and radio is fairly flat, going up, you know, maybe a percent or two, not much. And so the people that are gaining the most are not the legacy media businesses. It's the other guys. It's the Facebooks and the Googles. So in a way, they need to do this, they meaning the Murdochs, but everybody else as well, in order to counter what's going on with the digital global platforms, because they are having a huge amount of impact on not only how we get news, because they're a distribution platform, but also how that news is created and funneled to us. You know, a lot of people are getting their news from Facebook, which means they're getting their news from their Facebook friends, which means it's all part of an algorithm, which means it's part of a, they're just in this little narrow valley getting their news. It's not like they're getting a newspaper where there might be a bunch of different voices in it, right?
Yeah.
So that's the, my prediction for 2017 is that's what we're going to see. We're going to see more media consolidation. We're going to see a lot more, let us say, money going into figuring out how to stand out in this very fragmented, noisy media landscape. And I also think there's going to have to be something done about journalism, because we need journalism. We need it to help our democracies be healthy, to make people know that they know what's happening out there and hopefully inform them. And I'm hoping that there's going to be a little bit of a reboot in how we do that and how that is funded.
You talked earlier about investigative journalism and how newspapers are just not, they've got no money to put into that. And that's one of the most important things that newspapers used to do. I mean, you only have to watch movies like Spotlight to realize the impact that great investigative journalism can have. If the platforms aren't there, and I mean print, I mean, let's face it, print's not going to be around forever in the way it was. Who will it be that is actually going to carry out that really good investigative journalism if it isn't print?
Well, keep in mind, print, you know, print is, I mean, we'd say print.
Yes.
So when I say The Guardian, you think, oh, a printed newspaper. Yeah. But actually, they're one of the biggest online
Daily Mail is,
you know, quote, newspaper companies. Daily Mail, right. So it's not really about paper anymore, print. We use that as a shorthand to describe what they are. But they are all digital now. I mean, all these outlets are now digital.
But they're not making much money, though, are they?
Right. So that's the transition point. They're trying to figure out how to make money in the digital world. That was my point before. The people that are getting the most money from the digital world are not what I call the legacy businesses.
Yeah.
The Guardians, even the Daily Mail is probably doing the best in that world.
Yeah.
But so where is the money going to come from is your question for investigative journalism. Well, there are some things that are happening. There's like ProPublica. There's some online investigative sites that have sprung up mm-hmm. that are funding investigative journalism through, you know, foundation donations, through crowd funding, where, you know, you ask people on the internet to put money into a project. So there are things like that that are happening. But my belief is that we have to somehow make sure that what we used to call the big brands, like the New York Times, like the Washington Post, like the Guardian, you know, like the Telegraph, you know, people that, you know, news providers, don't call them print, but news providers still have some kind of voice because they have the, let's say, the expertise, the background, they know how to do it. And when you start to look at other companies that are starting to come up, like, you know, we have BuzzFeed now, we have Business mm-hmm. Insider, and a lot of those are doing some very good work. Vice News is totally online, for targeted towards young people. These are sort of the new kids on the block doing news. But, because they're trying to make money in this digital world, a lot of them, they're spending, like, for instance, there's this joke in news medium, the listicle. Have you heard of this term, the listicle?
No.
In other words, you know, what are the top 10?
Like the BuzzFeed things. Yeah.
BuzzFeed does that. So what's the top 10, I don't know, best Christmas hats, right?
Yeah.
And they will get more clicks on that story than they will on something that's trying to, you know, pick apart what's going on with, you know, the EU, for example, right?
Yeah.
So we've got kind of, you know, there's that problem there. So how do you surface the news? How do you make sure that people are actually going to read something that's going to actually help them understand what's actually going on, as opposed to just something that's fun and, you know, cats on skateboards or whatever it is, which is great. I mean, I'm not against cats on skateboards. That's great. I love cat videos. But you know, the other stuff is important too. So, you know, that's the challenge. I don't have an answer. If I had an answer, I'd be out there setting it up. But I mean, something needs to be done. There are things that are happening. There's movement in the right direction, and I am optimistic, basically, that we will come out of the other end on this.
Yeah. Just talking of funding, the BBC in this country, a lot of people in America are surprised, some even shocked, that you need a license to watch television in this country. They're used to things being licensed that are dangerous, like guns and cars, but in this country, you need a license to watch television. It's £145 a year. Around 200,000 people every year are prosecuted. Dozens are in jail, literally, for watching television. There's been a lot of talk this year and in previous years about whether that the licensing system that they have is sustainable, because they basically, you know, the government sends heavies round and demands that you pay the money if you don't pay it, or it feels like that anyway. The future for funding for the BBC, do you see it changing anytime soon, the licensing model going away?
Well, keep in mind, my career has been about covering what I call the pay TV space. So, I've spent a lot of my career covering pay television companies like Sky, like Comcast, like Virgin Media in this country, the growth of pay television, Netflix, that kind of stuff. But that said, I believe that the BBC is a very special institution, and I believe it deserves to be funded. I believe that if it wasn't funded the way it was funded, it wouldn't be funded as well as it is funded, and I think that would be a great loss for the British cultural and political and, you know, from entertainment all the way through to, you know, high culture, to this culture, to this economy, to the UK. If you look at the US, the equivalent that we have is something called PBS, which is, you know, has, it basically doesn't have three shekels to rub together. I mean, it's run on a shoestring. They do a very good job given what they, you know, have in terms of their budget. But it is nowhere near the kind of powerhouse that the BBC is. I mean, I'll just harken back to something that Mark Rylance said. Mark Rylance is an actor who has achieved now, I guess, international fame. He was in Bridge of Spies. He was the Russian agent in Bridge of Spies with Tom Hanks. He's just been in Nice Fish. He did the movie The BFG, The Big Friendly Giant, which is that marvelous Ronald Dahl film that just came out, which is lovely, by the way. I highly recommend it if you haven't seen it. Good for kids as well. But he said to me, he was the star in a series on the BBC called Wolf Hall, and which is about Cromwell. And he played Cromwell. And he said to me, you know, all this other stuff that I did, you know, the getting the movie with Tom Hanks, you know, moving into feature films, doing this animation, none of this would have been possible if I hadn't done Wolf Hall. And Wolf Hall wouldn't have been possible without the BBC, because it was it's the kind of costume drama that costs a lot of money, that is an intellectual, you know, it's a beautiful piece of television, but it's not highly commercial. Do you know what I mean? It's not something that you do if you're trying to, if your big goal is to make a lot of money, right? I mean, right? Wow. So, and if you've seen Wolf Hall, you know, it's a wonderful piece, and it talks about British history, and it talks about Cromwell, and it's fantastic. But I thought that was really insightful for him to say, you know, without this my part in this thing, I wouldn't have been able to go on and do these other things, and that wouldn't have been possible without the BBC. So let's not slam the BBC.
Yeah.
Just because they are a well-funded organization. In fact, it's good that they are a well-funded organization. I believe that, in fact, the British population is better educated about what's going on in the world because of the BBC. So I think that, yes, there will be pressure against how it's funded now, and certainly to the level to which it's funded now, because people are going to say, well, I don't watch that much BBC, or I don't listen to that much BBC. You know, I'm doing this other stuff. I may have a Sky subscription, or I may have a Netflix subscription, and why am I having to pay all this money? So I think there will be some pressure. Probably at some point we'll have to get to the point where you will decide whether you're more of a radio listener, and maybe you want to pay more for radio. You know, I mean, who knows? There'll be pressure on the license fee as is today. But in my mind, it's something that you should preserve, and it's something that we as a country, as you know, British citizens, should be supporting, because there's nothing else like it in the world, and it's one of the best news and entertainment organizations out there, bar none. You've heard it here first.
Finally, what are you personally looking forward to in 2017?
let's see. What am I looking forward to in 2017? Well, in the short term, I'm looking forward to some really nice powder days on the ski slope. Is that good enough?
Yeah, that's good. Kate Bulkley, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time. Where can we find out more about you?
Well, I have a website online. I write for Broadcast Magazine. I write for The Guardian occasionally, so you can Google me. You can certainly do it there, and I'm often a guest pundit on various shows and things like that, mostly business related, I have to say. So if you're not into the business of media, you probably won't hear too much about me. But it's been a joy talking to you. Thank you, Graham. It's really lovely to sort of go over your career a little bit. It's you don't often get that chance, so I appreciate it.
Kate Bulkley, thank you so much once again. Cheers.
This is London Calling.
That's it for this week. More next week. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Graham Mac. If you want to hear more Mac Nuggets, check out my website, macmedia.co.uk, and subscribe to my Bob FM show on iTunes. Got a question or something you'd like to say? Send me an email. If you put your phone number in the email, I might call you back or even Skype you on the show. My email address is graham@macmedia.co.uk. You spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next time, ta-da!